The Old Testament, the book of Joshua, chapter 14. The land of Transjordan, east of Jordan, having been allotted to the 2.5 tribes, to their eventual undoing, let it be said, aged Joshua with Eleazar the high priest and the heads of the tribes proceeded to allot the land proper, Canaan, to the remaining 9.5 tribes. These provinces, as we may call them, were assigned by lot, the method chosen by which to determine the will of God for these tribes. We learn that the 9.5 tribes consisted of all the others minus Levi, whose province, you remember, was the Lord. The number to 9.5 being made up by the tribe of Joseph becoming 2 because it was so large, Manasseh and Ephraim, and the Levites being given 48 towns to live in with pasture for their flocks and their herds. But before we come to the general allotment, with Judah first, of course, interestingly enough, the men of Judah approach Joshua and his committee. We'll call them a committee, which is very up to date, isn't it? And Caleb, who was one of them, of the tribe of Judah, said, "Just a minute, Joshua. There's a prior matter to be discussed before you allot Judah's territory. You know that you and I were the 2 spies who went up to Canaan from Kadesh Barnea, and on reconnoitering the land, recommended Israel to go right up into it and take it despite the giants, just as the Lord commanded. Because the Lord assured us that by his help we would be well able to take it. But you remember, Joshua, that this was overborne by the 10 pessimists who went up with us, who feared the giants more than they feared the Lord, and flagrantly disobeyed the Lord, landing Israel in 38 years of wandering in circles in the wilderness until all the adults had died but ourselves too. And here we are now, Joshua, very old men. I don't know about you, Joshua, because as leader of all Israel, you have the right to choose where you will abide. But I have no such honor. No such honor has been placed on me as upon you, having been Moses' assistant. But doubtless you will recall, Joshua, that when we were sent up into the land with the other 10, we brought back a good report of the land, and the 10 an adverse report, which ill report by them was carried by the whole people, and our advice was not followed, with the result that it took 40 years to reach Canaan instead of a year or 2. And you remember, Joshua, that on that day the Lord was so grieved with Israel as to want to destroy them. But Moses pleaded for Israel, and the Lord relented, not for the first time. But he declared did the Lord, that not one of those who had disobeyed his command would ever see the promised land. They would die in the desert. But Joshua, remember that the Lord was gracious to me on that day. Numbers 14 and 24, we want to look it up. And the Lord said that because I had a different spirit and followed the Lord wholeheartedly, he would bring me into the very land I had traversed with my own feet, and that my descendants would inherit it. And on that day, as you will recall, Joshua, Moses swore to me from the Lord that when Israel eventually entered the land, I would be given the land I spied out for my inheritance. A speech something like that. But it's interesting that Joshua is not mentioned there with Caleb, although it is Joshua who is first mentioned in the same 14th chapter of Numbers, verse 6. Joshua protesting against the judgment of the ten not to go up into the land. And I take it that since Joshua became leader of Israel after Moses, it was only fair that his companion Caleb, who had followed the Lord so faithfully against the advice of the ten, should be honored for his faithfulness, since reward, listen to this, since reward is an essential element in good government. You agree with that? Reward is an essential element in good government. It is also interesting that this land included Hebron, which is where Abraham and Sarah are buried at the tomb of Machpelah. Now, did you know, those who have been there will know, that it is now a Mohammedan mosque, which I for one have visited. And it was near Hebron at Eshcol, not so far from the oaks of Mamre, from Abraham's time, the trunks of the oaks of Mamre were still there when I was there in 1965, and I suppose are still there, although some of the acorns that I picked from underneath were sterile. But that was only 4,000 years ago that Moses sat under the oaks of Mamre. Well, that's near Eshcol. And you remember that the spies brought back huge bunches of luscious grapes, the luscious grapes of Eshcol. And they brought them back, great bunches on a pole, to prove against the adverse judgment of the ten that it was a good land that they were refusing to go into. And, you know, as a matter of further interest, from a spiritual point of view, is it not significant that these giant sons of Anak, demonically begotten creatures like those of Genesis chapter 6, should have been situated where the land was fair and its produce so fruitful? What were they doing with evil creatures in such a lovely land? And we might also ask, what were they doing with such evil creatures in the lovely land of Sodom and Gomorrah that Lot chose? Why was it that the giant sons of Anak were there? Did they prefer good land? Well, where the Lord is most fruitful, there Satan and his crew will hover like the vultures they are. That's why fruitfulness in the Lord's service is the most dangerous condition for the Lord's servants to be in. You're in a certain danger when things are not going well in the Lord's service, but not such a great and subtle danger as when things are going so well that we forget him and become proud of ourselves. So we've got to be very, very careful of the subtlety of demons when the Lord's work is going well. So Caleb said to Joshua, "That was 45 years ago, and I am now 85. Don't you think it time that the Lord's will, declared in my favor and confirmed by Moses' oath, should now be fulfilled?" Nor, you might imagine Caleb adding intriguingly, "Nor am I asking this as a retirement present, for I'm just as vigorous and strong today as I was 45 years ago, and as ready to go out to battle giants as I was then. So hand it over, Joshua." But that's not all. It was in this part of the land, spied out by the 12, that these giant sons of Anak dwelt. And apparently they were still there. Well, you may see by the map issued last Sunday morning that that is practically adjacent westwards to the Philistine territory and Goliath's city of Gath. It's the same area. "Now," says Caleb, that doughty old man, "I am just as fit to deal with the creatures now as I was then. Let me have a go." And I think that even the least imaginative of you here will see what this is saying to me personally, especially the 45 years. For there are still giants in the land, aren't there? When the so-called leaders of our church spend their time denouncing those whom, on the other hand, they hypocritically admit to be prosperous spiritually, both in terms of men and money, and yet they revile them. The most living churches in Scotland are reviled by so-called leaders of the church. Poor old George Reed has gone, did you see in the newspaper, who used to be our neighbor across the road, and was cordial enough to us then, but as soon as he went to Edinburgh, changed his tune. And it was only in May this year that George Philip wrote to the editor of Life and Work, saying, "Would it not be an act of mercy to grant us all a year of sabbatical rest from the fulminations of Dr. Reed?" But the present moderator has taken George Reed's place and has used his moderatorial year to denounce us even more roundly than George Reed did. Fortunately, in a few short months, he will return to the cloisters of Trinity, Glasgow, and confine his efforts to deny great evangelicals to there, although Glasgow Divinity Hall in recent years has been one of the strongest factions of evangelical divinity students in the whole country, Perhaps nowhere in Scotland have liberal scholars had less effect than in Trinity. Yes, there are still giants to fight, said Caleb. Now give me this hill country, Joshua, that the Lord promised me that day, and with the Lord's help I will drive the giants out just as the Lord said. Now what do you think that is saying to us today? What's the message this morning? I'll tell you what I'm thinking. I was looking up the first volume of our history. Have some of you never read these volumes of the history of these long years? I was reading the first volume, and after reading of Dr. Lloyd Jones' first visit to Aberdeen in September 1960, I came upon this in the July minister's letter for that year. Are we who are cozily settled in our own domestic happiness really concerned with the influence of our church beyond our own congregation? And the answer some may give is no. But we have no option. What if God resurrected Gilcomston South, not in the interests of its own domestic life, but in the interests of the wider church? I am sure, I said then, that this is the reason for our continued existence. That's 30 years ago. That we may no longer turn in upon ourselves and settle down to a comfortable social life, but must have a care for God's larger purpose. Ah, yes, but to change the whole ethos of the Church of Scotland back to what she has been and ought to be still will surely take generations. That is, short of almighty Holy Ghost revival. Could happen quickly then. And of course, that's what this deep digging, plodding ministry that has been going on for well on to half a century now, and that most people haven't the faintest idea it is trying to do. This is very probably what the Lord means us to be preparing for revival in our land, however long delayed. You know how it started here. It started because the one thing I stipulated to the vacancy committee who interviewed me here in the church in 1945, the one thing I stipulated was that they would let me have a prayer meeting. I asked, and they pressed me, and I asked absolutely nothing else. That we would have a prayer meeting. They said I could have my prayer meeting if I came. And I said, but it would be your prayer meeting. But most of these dear people that I'll learn to love and live with died without ever attending the prayer meeting. But that didn't stop it. It started during the July holidays, when people said, ridiculous, wait until the holidays are over. No! Right away. That didn't stop it. And you see, the non-attendance of so many today doesn't stop it either. Why, people come Did you know that people come from all over the world to attend our prayer meeting more than to attend our services on Sunday? And yet some people wouldn't cross the street to attend our prayer meeting. When I came here, I didn't know of one prayer meeting held in a church in Scotland anywhere. There must have been one or two, I think, but I hadn't heard of them. And then, you see, I was organist of the Gallagate Kirk. Some of you young people wouldn't know about that because it was bombed during my student days and ceased to exist. And, you know, that congregation of Gallagate was as evangelical as any in the town. But it hadn't a prayer meeting. But, you see, there must be now hundreds of prayer meetings regularly taking place in churches all over Scotland. It could be, you know, that the Scottish Church is now second in praying power only to the great Korean Church. Sinclair Ferguson, just back from Korea, says, spiritually, Korea is another world from the West, with fabulous crowds meeting for prayer early in the morning, from 5 o'clock in the morning. Crowds! Thousands! But here, because corporate prayer is such a hidden, unpublicized work, the fruits of it will be seen long before its practice is known and acknowledged. For such an activity is so foreign to churches today, including evangelical churches throughout the Western world, that most evangelicals in America have given up trying to gather people together for corporate prayer. They've given it up long ago. Christians won't come. And yet, prayer is the heart of the Korean church, which we may soon find will be spilling all over the world in a tremendous outreach to the godless West. Wait and see. I think I now see, then, that for all our emphasis on prayer and the insistence that it must go on summer and winter without fail, whoever is present or absent, has not been enough. I don't think that even our evangelical churches have got the message sufficiently of the absolute all importance of prayer. One of the most fruitful Christian unions in the universities in Scotland in recent years has been that of Aberdeen University. And its blessing has been due largely to the very high proportion of its young members who have gathered weekly for a season of real prayer. Of course, this has been due to a prior emphasis on the teaching of the Word. But they tell me the impulse to gather for prayer is weakening somewhat today in its appeal, and I am therefore very concerned about the future of the Christian Union, which I've been associated with now for over 50 years. Very concerned about the future of it, and on that account I am also concerned about the future of the Lord's work here. For the same reason. They say, you know, that Christian young people today, in our too affluent society, are obsessed, Christian young people are obsessed with pleasure and entertainment. And do you know what is responsible for a great deal of that? Beyond television, of course, and videos and all that. Nothing but guitars. Cliff Richards. What did he do the Sunday evening he was in town but hold a full-blooded worldly concert on the Lord's Day evening with extravagant prices for tickets, pounds and pounds to attend a racket with so much noise that the journalist covering the thing said you couldn't even hear yourself think. Whereas the rule, you know, in my Salvation Army days, which is not yesterday, the rule was that Christians never attended anything they had to pay admission for. Nothing. Even a football match. If we wore the Salvation Army uniform, no drink, no paying for admission to any of those things, that was old William Booth's idea. For you see, that was mere entertainment and worldly. You know, as far as I hear, some of our young people have had a week of pleasure seeking this past week. But none were at Bible study on Wednesday. We are doing the vital first chapters of Genesis, and after dealing with chapter 3 a week or two ago, I appealed to the congregation that everyone should have been there to hear what we were saying about the fall in Genesis 3. Well, I took it on Wednesday, and the hall was practically empty. But none of these young people missed the annual party on Friday. Have you read what I wrote about celebrations of Christian weddings in the December Record? And do you think it's not possible that some of us may be beginning to lose the place? I should hate to think that I was in danger of raising a generation of young people who denied in practice what they were meant to stand for. Because, you see, in that case, this new spire that is going to be built would soon become a place for a museum or a block of flats or even a disco. Like the filthy establishment up the road. Do you know, you people sitting here this morning, do you know that emblazoned across the front of that drinking den up the road in Summer Street is the title, Filthy Nasties. Filthy Nasties. What in the face of the earth were our city fathers thinking about allowing that vile cavern to be sited on Summer Street? But then, how can we train the children and the young people to be prayer warriors if that is the heart of the church's work? Because mere church activity won't do the work. Only prayer will do the work. How can we train children and young people to be prayer warriors if parents and older people don't show them an example? The promise that parents make at the baptism of their children is that they will bring them up, they will bring up their children by prayer, precept, and example. Are we in danger, do you think, of gathering a whole contingent of people together who have no real part in the essence of the church's work? Could it be that what is needed is a purging of the role? Of two or three roles, if you see what I mean. I wonder. As an old cable, Caleb, Freudian slip, as an old Caleb, that's his name, after 45 years. You know that this will be my 46th Christmas here. After 45 years, I am still as keen as ever to demolish the giants of godlessness in our land and in our town. And I want the practical support of those who will stand by me. And I'm inviting you to be among them. I don't care how few they be, as long as they are as true as Caleb was after half a lifetime, 45 years. Because, you know, we could yet see greater things in this congregation and throughout the church in Scotland than we have ever seen. For, you know, Almighty, full-scale Holy Ghost revival is on the biblical cards. It has to be. It is yet to be. God has decreed it. But when? When? Are we preparing for it? On the knees of our hearts? I think we'd better get going, because, you know, the Koreans may soon come and show us the way. We've had lovely Korean families here who have been an example to us. So many things. They may soon come and show us the way. And you know, that would be very humiliating for the Scots. It would be more humiliating for the Scots for the Koreans to come here and show us the way than it would be for the English or the Welsh or the Irish or anybody else. Shall I tell you why? It was the Scots who first went to Korea. Ask them. Not the Americans. It was the Scots who first went to Korea to show them the way. Have we then to relearn our true task? I leave that with you. And all that I will say further is, I, for as long as God gives me breath and strength and cogency of mind, I am committed to a life of prayer here. That as in the spring of this year we hope our tower may begin to be rebuilt, a new church in Gilcomston may rise to glorify God in days to come.